is actually supposed to be a representation of something called the doomsday clock. How many of you have heard of the doomsday clock? Okay, so based on the doomsday clock, which if you know your history, at the end of the Second World War, after the nuclear bomb was put into production, the lead physicist, along with Albert Einstein and other leading physicists in the world, formed this organization, which still exists today. And they have this clock called the Doomsday Clock. And it's supposed to represent how close we are to midnight. And midnight represents the destruction of mankind. It's a pretty dark kind of theme. And they've been keeping this time since the 1940s. And so what time is it? Do you know what time is it? Do you know what time it is on the doomsday clock today? According to the physicists that maintain it, it's 2 minutes to midnight. It's varied since its inception between 17 minutes and 2 minutes. When there's a world crisis, when there's war, the time ticks down and they say we're closer to destroying our planet and all of mankind. And then when there's peace, when the Berlin Wall fell, it went back, you know, and so we had a little more margin. But the question for us this morning, and I'm going to say it to you again and again today, and I want you to take this home. Ask yourself, what time is it? The book of Esther, you know, a lot of people say that the Bible is boring. Yeah. I remember in all of our Sunday school training when we work with children that Miss Ty, if you remember Miss Ty, she said, the Bible's not boring. The teachers are boring. Right? And she was right. And so it helped me to put more effort into learning how to study the Bible. And I think all of our teachers, children, teens, adults, even in the nursery, I think we're all bearing the fruit of that study. The book of Esther is often neglected. As I studied this and as I went through different secondary sources, there are some very good commentary series that don't even have a book on Esther. And I don't remember ever hearing a sermon on the book of Esther. My memory's not very good, but it's a book that we often neglect. And if we think that the Bible is boring, let me set this up for you. So this is the story. This is better than any Disney film you will ever watch. This book is about royalty. And we know that there's going to be a royal wedding next month. This is royalty in the extreme. There is a lot going on. Here are the characters in this biblical account. There's this king who in the NIV has an easier pronounced name, Xerxes, but in our ESV version it's Ahasuerus, which is actually in the Hebrew. So we'll stick with that. It's more accurate. So there's the king. He's the king over the Persian Empire, which if you look at our missions map, where's Persia? Point to it. Well, you can't be wrong because I can't see where you're pointing anyway. So you're all correct. Very good. You know your geography. So King Ahasuerus is the king over the Persian Empire. This succeeded the Babylonian Empire. And we don't have time to go through the whole book of Esther, but in chapter 1, if you know the account, he gets rid of his queen, Queen Vashti. He's very upset, and so there's an opening for a queen. Enter, who will become the queen, is Esther, who is an orphan, a Jew, an exile, carried away in a foreign land. And then we have Mordecai. Mordecai is the cousin, the older cousin of Esther. And he is descended from King Saul. We see that in Esther chapter 2, verse 6. So remember that. It's going to be significant. And then we have every good story has a protagonist, or has a villain, sorry. And in this case, the villain is Haman. And Haman is the highest official in this royal court. And he just happens to be descended from the enemies of Israel, the enemy of Mordecai, the enemy of Esther. You remember the Amalekites. He's descended from King Agag. Remember that too. So this is a really intricate story of royal intrigue because there's so much going on in the royal court. There is great conflict between Mordecai and Haman. And we're going to see that in a moment. When we look at biblical history, we see that when Jerusalem fell in 587, 586 BC, there were about 4,600 people, Jeremiah 52 tells us, 4,600 people were taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar. And then the Babylonian Empire fell, the Persians took over. By the time of the book of Esther, there are 50,000 people. We know that from Ezra chapter 2, because there are 50,000 people accounted for there. So there are 50,000 people. And what is this conflict? There's a conflict because Haman was elevated to be the highest noble person in the court of King Ahasuerus. And everyone was supposed to bow to him at the gate. But one person refused to bow. That man is Mordecai. He says, because he's a Jew, and he knows the history, the Jews and the Amalekites are sworn enemies. And now the enemy of the Israelites is elevated and in some sense worshipped. And Mordecai, being a devout Jew, would have none of this. So he said, no way, I am not bowing to you. So there's big conflict. And so let's look at this conflict. And if you can read that, I hope the font's not too small. And I'm just going to summarize what you see there in red because it's a fairly long passage. So Mordecai refuses to bow down. Haman, on the other hand, because he's been elevated, he's so full of himself and he's so filled with rage that this Jew, who he also knows is his enemy, refuses to bow down to him. And so there's a big conflict. And the conflict gets worse because Mordecai, being the enemy of Haman, Haman decides to go to the king and ask him for an edict. An edict is basically a royal command that cannot be overturned. And the command is that all the Jews will die. 50,000 Jews. The whole remnant of the nation of Israel, except for those poor who were left behind by Nebuchadnezzar in Jerusalem, the bulk of the Israelite nation existed now, 50,000, in the Persian Empire. And there was an edict. We call this genocide. And all the letters went out in Esther chapter 3. So let's continue our backstory. Let's just quickly go through this. So what happens? And keep your hands, your fingers open, pointing at Esther chapter 4. And we're going to quickly go through this chapter again. So in Esther chapter 4, first of all, Mordecai finds out about this edict in verse 1. He and all the Jews mourn. They wear sackcloth. Sackcloth. Anybody have sackcloth in their closet? You know, some of you have Canada Goose. Sackcloth is Canada goat, okay? It's coarse goat hair, not very comfortable. And it was traditionally worn with ashes put on your head in times of severe mourning, in times of despair, in times of falling to the ground at the feet of God and begging. Have you been there before? Have you ever prayed like that? I believe the church needs to pray like that. So this is happening in verse 1. Not only Mordecai, but all the Jews who have now heard of this edict, they're marked for destruction. And there's great wailing and moaning and grieving. Then we move on. So then we look through verses 4 to verse 7. Esther now finds out about this despair of her cousin, Mordecai. So she sends her servants, find out what's going on. Her servants go, they find out, they report back to Esther. Let's find out what happens next. So then in verses 8 and 9, Mordecai commands his younger cousin, Esther, and he says, you go to the king and beg for our nation. Beg for our nation. And then in verses 10 to 12, what does Esther say? She says, don't you know the rules? Everybody knows the rules. Not just me, not just the royal court, not just Haman. Everyone in all of the provinces, 127 provinces in this most populous nation on earth, all know the rule that if you go to see the king without an invitation, unless he puts out his golden scepter and points it at you, you're dead. You cannot go without an appointment. She tells Mordecai, what you're asking for is for me to take mortal risk for the sake of Israel. What does Mordecai respond? Two parts. He gives a threat in verses 13 and 14, which is where we're going to spend most of our time. He gives a threat, and then he recognizes an opportunity. I tried to depict that threat. Do you see what that threat is? It's a pair of chopsticks. If you were raised in an Asian family, you know what those chopsticks are good for. They're good for eating. They're also weapons. If you've ever reached over the table to try to take something that was far away from you, out came your parents' chopsticks. Rack. Okay. So this is what we call the stick. And then we'll look at the carrot. And every kid from grade 5, we have kids here in grade 5, grade 6, all of you teens in Genesis up to grade 12, you all know how the carrot and the stick works. When your parents say to you, okay, if you want to have a sleepover, you've got to finish your assignment. That's the carrot. And then the stick. But if you don't finish, you can't have your friends come over, and you're going to have to do extra chores. So there's a threat. There's a carrot. We're all familiar with that dynamic. And we see the same dynamic here. So there's a threat. And the threat in verse 13 is another mortal threat. And Mordecai says to his young cousin, if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Now, don't forget who's in Esther's house, her father's house, her relatives, includes Mordecai. Because he's not just saying this to her, but he's recognizing that there's a mortal threat for their family and for their whole nation. So he gives her that threat. And the carrot? He says in verse 14, that you have this opportunity. I'm going to read this out for you. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? What's the title of this sermon? What time is it? What's the doomsday clock? 2 minutes to midnight. What time is it for the Jews? They're about to die. What time is it for Esther? She has to go in to see the king uninvited. Time for her to die. What's going to happen to Mordecai because he refuses to bend to Haman, the enemy of the Jews? He and his whole family are going to die. And yet the carrot is, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? We're going to spend some time on that also. And by the way, the book of Esther often is omitted in study because people don't see the mention of God explicitly. But commentators will point, for example, to this verse and say, this speaks of God. The idea that deliverance will come for the Jews. From where? From God. These people are God-fearing. Even though we don't see the name of God explicitly mentioned, God's fingerprints are all over the book of Esther. It reminds me of a sermon illustration that I heard years ago. There was a woman living in an apartment building in Hong Kong, and she wasn't a believer. And she went to a gospel meeting, and she heard the gospel for the very first time. And she responded and said, "I want Jesus as my Savior." She went back to her apartment, and the first thing she did went to knock on her best friend's door across the hall and said, "I've got good news for you. Do you know about Jesus?" And her best friend said, "Yes, I'm a Christian." And the woman who was just saved slapped her friend in the face and said, "How dare you? How dare you? You knew the way to salvation, and you never told me. How dare you? What kind of friend? You want me to die, to perish for eternity?" Deliverance came for that woman, but woe to her friend who did not share with her. And that's what we see here. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, "Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel." What time is it? It's time to save our friends and family, our neighbors, our colleagues, our classmates, our roommates, because they face a mortal threat, as did Esther, as did Mordecai, as did all the Jews. And so for such a time as this, what is God calling us to do? I want to explore this notion of time. Some of us in this room went to a course. Where's Ryan? Is Ryan here? I don't see Ryan today. Ryan helped organize a course a few months ago called Kairos, and that's a Greek word. And in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, which was written around between the 3rd century BC, completed into the 1st century BC, in that period, what we call the post-exilic period, Jewish scholars translated the Old Testament into Greek. This is the text that was used by Jesus, the disciples, and those in the New Testament. This was their text. A lot of people couldn't read Hebrew anymore. When you're in captivity, you don't use your language. They adopted Aramaic, which is why the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic, not Hebrew. And so kairos is a Greek word. And in the Septuagint, this word tells us a lot. It means it's the decisive point of time. It's the right opportunity. Basically, again, I'm thinking of young people. When you hear your parents and they walk by your room, if you're so lucky as to have a room, I never had my own room, ever. But if you are so blessed to have your own room, and your parents walk by and they say, "This room's a mess. You should clean it up." And you say, yeah. And they say, "There's no time like the present." That's what kairos means. It's not just knowledge. I know I should clean my room. It's you should clean your room, and you should do it now. And you have the opportunity, and you should seize it. And then if you're in most Asian households, there is usually a mortal threat afterwards. Right? But basically, you get the idea. Kairos means do it now. So when you say it's time, you know, it's time for us to clean the church, and our building committee is working overtime on our behalf, it means if Stefan or Andrew or anyone on our building committee, Nathaniel or Paul, say it's time for us to take care of the church, they don't mean it's time, you know, you should go home and just recognize it's time. It's time, it's now. It's time for action now. That's what kairos means. That's why the name of that missions course is so appropriate. It means it's time to take action now. And we see that all over the New Testament, and just one portion of scripture there, you see in Luke chapter 12, and in context, the book of Luke, in chapter 12, Jesus is spending a lot of time rebuking the Pharisees. And he says, "You hypocrites, you know how to look at the sky and decide the weather for today. And you don't know the time that we're in now, that this is the time for the kingdom." And he says, before these verses, "I have come not to bring peace, but to bring division." He's talking about bringing revolution, that the gospel is not inert, that the gospel is not just knowledge, that the gospel is not just theology, but the gospel is life-saving. Do you want to be slapped in the face by your best friend, your aunt, your uncle, your mom, your dad, your grandparents, your roommate, your classmate, your colleague? Because one day they find out that you knew the gospel and you didn't share it? Kairos, now. And Jesus is rebuking the Pharisees who know the Septuagint. They know their Bible. They know the Torah. But what were they doing with it? You know that it's going to rain. You can see the clouds. But you don't know that God's judgment is coming. Well, you do know. But what are you going to do about it? Is your room clean? Yeah, Ma, I know I'm supposed to clean it. Now, Kairos. Oh, the kids are going to hate me because I've now given your parents the biblical imperative to use Kairos in your home. After the sermon, we'll be selling T-shirts on the third floor for all parents. And I see in the handout today that there's a CE class which looks so interesting on parenting. I'm sure they will have some Kairos T-shirts for you on display. So that's what Kairos means now, okay? We don't get the luxury of tomorrow. This is what Kairos means. Let me give you one further example. And if you're taking notes, I love it when people take notes. Is anyone taking notes? Are you guys taking notes? Okay, if you're taking notes, I want you to stop taking notes. Because right now I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you how not to get a job. Do not take notes. You can stop recording. It's okay. So the first real job I had, which I held for 20 years. So in the old days, you know, I had no job. And my brother told me to go to a place called Manpower. It's not called that anymore. It's like Service Ontario now. And you go there, and in the old days, they had bulletin boards and with real pins. And they had jobs on pieces of paper. Can you imagine that? And I went there to look for a job, and I saw something, and it wasn't a job I wanted because I trained in mathematics, and it was a job as a computer programmer, which is perfectly good, but I just didn't want this job. But I felt like, okay, I have no job. I'll just apply. I won't get it. I really don't care. I sent in my resume by mail. I wrote the name of the owner of the company. I spelled it wrong. Completely wrong. I botched it. He called me in nonetheless for an interview. I went for the interview. Now I'm going to ask the kids, because this was a computer job, and I really wasn't a computer scientist. And he asked me 24 acronyms, all from computer science. I got 23 wrong. Okay. For example, social media. LOL. Okay, harder one. AF. A-I-K? Okay. I-M-H-O? Oh, see. You're already better than me. Okay, if you asked me if this was 1986 when I had the interview, I would have gotten them all wrong. And he still hired me. I'm talking about the opportunity that God gives. We'll see in a moment the opportunities that Esther received. I received a similar set of opportunities. There's no way I should have been hired. And I found out after the fact that they didn't want to hire me either. But they wanted to hire someone from Hong Kong. They got some kind of federal grant. And they said, "You can't give this job to anyone who's not a Canadian citizen. You have to offer the job first to a Canadian. And if you can't find a Canadian, then you can hire that person." So they just did it out of obligation. And I did it out of obligation. I didn't want the job, and they didn't want me. And I didn't deserve the job because I knew nothing. And they hired me. But this is the opportunity I want to tell you about. 1 year later, I had my first performance review with the owner of the company. And we sat down, and this is the stupidest career advice you will ever hear from me. I said to him, "You know what? Do you remember the interview?" He said, "Yes." I said, "God gave me this job." He's not a Christian. I said, "God gave me this job, and don't write this down." And I said, "If you fire me today, I don't care." I said that to him. I said it to him because I said, because I know that God will provide for me. And throughout the years, I've been sharing the gospel with this person. Even I met him a few months ago. I've given him books. The point is that we all have opportunities to share the gospel, and they're unique. There's no one else I know of in this person's life who would share the gospel with him. And if he doesn't receive the gospel on the day he dies, I have a clear conscience that he's not slapping my face. And he knows that he is facing a mortal risk. And I have told him. And the rest is up to God. It's all up to God. The job I received was all God's doing. We are given opportunities. Do you see in your life a special set of opportunities? The people that you rub shoulders with, that only you can reach for the gospel. Let's look at Esther's Kairos moment. She's an orphan. Look at her unique set of opportunities. But Mordecai becomes her guardian and takes care of her. And then the queen has disfavor from the king. Wow, job opening. And then she's a Jew, but she hid her identity because her cousin told her to. And she, of all the women, she's not a native. She has no parents. She's the one who's chosen. She has. So when her cousin Mordecai says, "How do you know that God didn't give you this opportunity to save your people? How do you know that this isn't why you are here?" And as you know the book of Esther, the answer is, it is the reason. Kairos. Kairos. It's not time just to clean our room. It's time to usher in the kingdom. Is it going to snow today? Is it going to rain today? We know the weather. Do we know the kingdom is coming? Do we know that our friends, our aunts, our uncles, our grandparents, our parents, our children, our classmates, our colleagues, our teammates, that some of them are going to perish? They're facing a mortal threat. And what are we going to do? What is the opportunity that God has given to us? And so we have the challenge. Who knows, Esther, whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? What time is it? It's time. It's time for salvation. What I like about the book of Esther, it's actually, everyone reads it like a Disney account, and it is the best storyline, better than any Disney movie you'll ever watch. But there's such depth to this idea of salvation. We think, oh yeah, Esther, Kairos. The opportunity is now. You're going to save 50,000 people. Hooray, hooray. Fantastic. That's the present. And she does save them. As you read the rest of the account in chapter 9, 50,000 people were saved because Esther was obedient. But there's also the past. The past. Do you know, as I mentioned earlier, that Mordecai is descended from King Saul. And Haman is descended from Agag. And if you remember in 1 Samuel chapter 15, Samuel the prophet tells Saul, the king of Israel, go and destroy the Amalekites. They are the enemies of Israel. And what happens? Oh, they have a great battle, and God gives them great victory. But Saul doesn't fulfill the whole command, and he lets the king, Agag, live. And the best sheep, the plunder, they don't destroy. And that has weighed on the psychology of the Jews for all those centuries. There's a commentary of the Old Testament called the Targum, T-A-R-G-U-M. It's written in Aramaic because that was the language of the Persian Empire. And in that account of Esther chapter 4, it has extra sentences in it. It says, "Now, Esther, how do you know that you were not put here for such a time as this?" Yeah, that's fine. I see that in my ESV Bible. It's right there. But the Targum goes one step further. It actually interprets it further, and it says, "And we're in this mess because Saul didn't do the job. And that's why this despicable man named Haman lives, because he's a descendant of Agag, and he wouldn't be here, and we wouldn't be here, and we wouldn't be in exile if it wasn't for Saul." That's how the Jews looked at it. And King Saul, so he's around the 10th century. And now we're into the 5th century. We're talking more than 500 years of guilt. Have we made any mistakes? Have there people that we should have shared the gospel with and didn't? And we can feel that slap coming. For the Jews, it wasn't just to be saved for today, 50,000 people, but it was to be saved from the curse of 500 years of disobedience. That's how they viewed this. And so they celebrate something called Purim. And if you know the account from Esther, the pur, P-U-R, like there's a gum, right, called pure gum, P-U-R. And is that how they spell it? They spell it that way, right? So Purim is celebrated today by Jews once a year to commemorate. But when they commemorate the book of Esther, they also, through their history of Israel, when Stalin was ruling Russia and he was systematically killing the Jews, they remembered the book of Esther when they celebrated Purim. For the Jews, the book of Esther is a touchstone. It's a touchstone, and it represents God's salvation, not just in Susa, in Persia, in 127 provinces, in the 5th century, but today. So salvation runs deep for the Jews. It's huge. And what is Esther's response? Esther's response, she says, "Okay, pray and fast for me." How many of you were at our recent church prayer meeting? We've had a discussion at council whether we should resume fasting again. If you were here long enough, you'd know that we used to pray and fast when we met together as a church. So more to come in the days ahead. But usually when people fast, why do they fast? You're praying for something. You're praying for a job, and you're fasting. You're trying to say to God, "I am so dependent on you. I'm so sincere. I'm so nothing without you. Please answer my prayer." But that's not why Esther prayed and fasted. That's not why Mordecai prayed and fasted. That's not why the Jews throughout Susa and throughout the Persian Empire prayed and fasted. Because she had already decided that she would face the initial mortal risk of going in to see Mordecai uninvited. She had already made her decision. The scriptures tell us that. "I will go, but pray and fast for me," because she needed God's strengthening. And we see that in verse 16. So in response to "who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this," she says, "Go, gather them, and I will fast. You will fast, then I will go to the king." She doesn't say, "You fast, I fast, and then we'll decide." I've already decided. How many times do we know what we should do We know we should share the gospel, but we don't. But there's hope for us in the book of Esther. And we have opportunities to obey. And we need to ask ourselves, what situation am I in? Who has a locker beside me? Is this an accident? Who am I sharing a residence room with? Is this an accident? Who do I work with in my lab? Is that an accident? Who am I sitting beside on the subway? Is it an accident? Who am I related to? Well, maybe that's an accident. You think that way. You couldn't be my parents because I'm cool and you guys aren't. I've heard that before. There are no accidents. God has given us an opportunity. Esther decided. She knew what she had to do. Do we know what we need to do? It's time for us to share the gospel. Let me close with this. So, I'm going to pick on you. I'm going to pick on all of us today. All right? So, equal opportunity picking on everyone. All right? So, first of all, boomers. Okay, you know who you are. The boomers, born after the Second World War up to around 1961, you are called the baby boomers. You are wealthy. You may think I'm not wealthy, but mostly the boomers have the most wealth in all of human history. You have so many resources. Guess what? As we see in Luke chapter 16, we're supposed to use our wealth to win people for the gospel. Use your money. Use your money. I'm going to be talking about the millennials shortly. The millennials were born kind of roughly 1980 to 2000, okay? And the millennials, they love to share the gospel. They are teaching us. How many short-termers, Wallace? Is there not a renaissance of short-term missions going on? There are so many young people going, we can't keep track on the missions committee, and it's exciting what God is doing. But they need money. The boomers. I want you to give your money to the millennials. All right? When the offering comes, there will be a special basket. All right? Yeah. And then the ushers will be wearing t-shirts and will say, Kairos, now! Okay, boomers, you have money. We'll come back to you too. Asians, with all due respect to those who are not of the Asian persuasion, but we're surrounded by Asians in this room. We love education. Unfortunately, sometimes we worship education, and this is idolatry. But we love education. We have more degrees in this room than a thermometer. Right? Now, we read about the federal government telling us we couldn't have grant money if we didn't say that we would agree to take a stand positively for reproductive rights. And as a church, we said, no, we can't do that. So you people with the education, I challenge you to go into the public square, not just to write form letters and sign petitions, but to run for office, to use your education to debate, to write responses to the editorials in the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the National Post, like Pastor Werner does, on blogs and chat rooms. You are educated. You have the command of language. You have the presence of understanding politics. Kairos. Now is the time for the gospel. I talked about the millennials. The millennials are the most coached, the most mentored generation ever. Most millennials have more than one mentor. Okay, so learn to take some risks, millennials. Take some risks. Esther took some risks. Take some risks because you're the most coached, therefore you're also very risk averse because parents like me put you in a bubble. Well, it's time for that bubble to burst. And you've got to take risks like Esther did. Don't pray and fast. Should I share the gospel? Should I share the gospel? Should I go abroad? Should I consider every careers day that we have in Genesis or in any CGYG? You know, When have we had anyone? We had doctors and lawyers and teachers and engineers and accountants, and wonderful. We've taught our young people all about everything we learned, but we never invite pastors. We never invite missionaries to come for a careers night. No, no, heaven forbid that you should serve the Lord. Parents, when are we going to release our children to serve the gospel? And millennials, take the risk. Kairos, Esther. You guys didn't think you'd be let off, did you? The teens, you are the most tech savvy. You know, next Friday we have a speaker, you better come. And he's talking about using technology but not for addiction. And then in the missions conference in June, we have a special track for our teens, and a speaker is coming to talk about how to use Snapchat for the gospel. Imagine that. You've got to. It's Kairos. Back to the boomers. I have to pick on you because I'm a boomer too, so you get double whammy. You're the most healthy. Boomers are living too long. Can I say that? Can I say that? Aiya, this is a Chinese slap in the face. How dare you, you know? I took your long noodles and I cut them in half. Yes, boomers, we are. I'm not saying we're healthy. I got all kinds of physical afflictions, and I know you do, and that's why we pray for each other. But on objective historical evidence, we are the healthiest boomer generation ever. We're going to live too long. What are we going to do with our time? Do you know how many missions organizations are crying for volunteers? And our teens, we went to visit a Christian MPP at Queen's Park, and he said, I need volunteers. Who's going to help me get reelected? What are we going to do? Kairos. Last one. Where are we? We're in Toronto. Okay, for you who have been around for a while, I'm going to give you a fill in the blanks. I'll see whether you've been listening at all our membership meetings. And every time we have prayer meetings, we always say the same thing. Oh, we thank God for our church because we have a blank location. Fill in the blank. What is that adjective we always say? Dumpy? Dirty? I got married here. We got married right here. And when we came out, Evelyn in her white gown, you know, someone spat on the sidewalk. Is that what it is? So what is it? Chinese Gospel Church has a what location? What is it? Huh? Spiritual? You guys haven't been paying attention. All these membership meetings. We always say, thank God for our strategic location in Chinatown. You ever hear that? You will hear it. You hear it more and more as we talk about the vision for our church. We are in Chinatown. We're surrounded by Asians. How are we reaching them? Okay, what time is it? What time is it? It's time, guys. It is time. It is time. The doomsday clock tells us it's what time? It's 2 minutes to midnight. And if we appropriate that for the gospel, it's 2 minutes to the return of Jesus. It is. We are always closer to the return of Jesus than when we began this sermon. And what will happen to our friends, our colleagues, our classmates, our relatives, our teammates, our neighbors, our friends, our family? What's going to happen to them? It is 2 minutes to midnight, and Esther saved her people because she recognized she was in a unique opportunity, and she took it. So must we. Let me close with just one more thing, Stefan, sorry. Is I often pray. Do you ever pray for people to receive the gospel? Now put up your hands if you pray for people. Yeah, I'm praying all the time. Thank you. Do you know that you might be the answer to someone else's prayer? As I pray, for example, for my sister in BC, I'm thinking, and the way I pray for her is very specifically. I say, God, bring someone into her dance group. Make a neighbor move in to her neighborhood who will share the gospel with her. And as I pray that, God always convicts me. And Albert, you are the answer to someone's prayer. Have you shared the gospel with your neighbor lately? Your grocer, your phone provider. Have you? How dare you pray for your family that someone would get off their backside and do something to bless your family if you don't do Kairos? Now is the time. What time is it? It's time for us to share the gospel.